I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer.
This is The Road to Now.
And today, Bob, The Road to Now takes us to a conversation that a literal road was supposed to take us on in 2020.
That's right.
We are joined here with two great, great performers and writers. We've got John Logan and should I call you Johnny? John Gallo? It's what it says on your screen.
Yeah, that is what I've put my Zoom moniker as. I answer to just about anything, but yes, a lot of folks. I'm named John on my birth certificate, but a lot of friends call me Johnny.
Okay. So we're friends now. That's great.
Yeah, exactly.
That was quick. All right. We'll see you guys later. Just kidding. we were supposed to go out to Berkeley. This musical that you guys worked on was supposed to open last year. And the amazing thing is your musical swept away. It's just opened up. And we're so excited to have you here to see that things are getting back and getting strong.
Yeah. You know, I'm really impressed that the first, let's just say, like, this will air on Monday. And this is the Monday a week before it will air, so everybody knows. And last night was the first performance of Swept Away. So first of all, I'll let you guys speak in a second here, but wow, that you could do this in the midst of Omicron, right? That you just powered through. That's great, and it's a testament to the safety protocols that Berkeley Rep has in place, and also, by way of introduction, how'd it go?
Will you tell it from the stage, Johnny, and I'll tell it from the audience.
Okay, sure. You're absolutely right, Bob. It's been a little hairy and touch and go the last few weeks watching this spike, make its way across the country. And so we were all a little nervous, but they're taking great care of us at the Berkeley Rep, and we're getting tested regularly, and there's great protocols in place for the audience. And lo and behold, we had a nearly sold out crowd at the theater last night for our very first preview. And, it was magical. I found myself just, pinching myself left and right at the fact that at this moment in time, after over a year long hiatus after we were supposed to premiere this show, to be up on stage premiering a new work of theater in America right now felt like nothing short of a miracle. And yet there was an ease and an inevitability to the proceeding that felt so glorious. And it was I'm still kind of riding high from it. It was a really special night, and I'm just feeling just tons of gratitude for the chance, for the ability to get up on stage with this show. It's really a blessing.
And John Logan, the man whose words and story was depicted on that stage, how did you feel it went?
Well, it was a great night. And I think Johnny hits the nail on the head, which for theater makers like me and Johnny, we're theater mouse. The last 2 years have been catastrophic. Shows have closed. Everyone we know is out of work. In New York, in London, in LA, everywhere. Regional theaters are suffering. Audiences don't want to come. Shows are closing. It's been a traumatic, seismic shock, unlike anything I've been writing plays for 40 years. I've never experienced anything like this and could never imagine we'd be at this point. But, theater is the fabulous invalid, and we will keep coming back. And so, to me, I felt the most extraordinary sense of joy and gratitude just to be in a theater with other people, knowing that we're like, there's light ahead, and we've got to keep going. And, the cast and the crew and the director and everyone all believe sort of the same thing. So it was a little bit sacred being there last night, just feeling a sense of grace that theater can bring when a collective comes together to tell a story and there's people to hear a story. So even over the usual first preview nerves and wondering, is this song going to work? Is that joke going to land? There was just this feeling of like, this is important that we're trying to do this thing right now.
So for those of you who are listening and don't know the connection here, because it might not be immediately obvious. So John Logan has written this new musical that is premiering this week. And it's an interesting story because there's a historical event that inspired the Avett brothers, that's Bob, Seth, and Scott, to write this album, Mignonette. And that is an interpretation of a moment. And now this musical that John has written and that, Johnny is performing in is just opened. And I think it's a fantastic story of how inspiration can spread and how you don't, you know, you think about history, there's the facts, right? And then there's the inspiration that creates one thing and then the next thing. And it's this kind of this beautiful example of what art can be and how inspiration grows. So could you talk about that and kind of how the music on the album Mignonette that the Avid Brothers put out then came to you, John Logan, to be this musical?
Well, it began in the strangest possible way, like every good artistic thing does, which is I got an email out of the blue in 2018. You know, cast your mind back to the golden days of 2018. And it was from our producer, Matthew Maston, a man I had never met, didn't know anything about. And he said, hey, do you know the Avid Brothers music? I think their album Mignonette could be a stage piece. What do you think? And that was the email. And, you know, I emailed back, I know I'm never supposed to do this, and my agent would be very happy, unhappy that I'm doing this, but yes, damn yes. I love this idea because I knew the Avid's music. I was sort of like a moderate fan, not a gigantic, enough to know that there was so much scope in what you guys do and so much variety and breadth and truth and beauty. I thought, this is a brilliant idea. You know, so I listened obsessively to Mignonette. You know, and then I went back to Matthew and said, okay, I'm in if one thing, if the band will give me access to their entire song catalog. Because Mignonette, although a wonderful concept album, didn't lend itself entirely to the stage. So I knew I needed to bring in other songs to create characters. And then as Johnny knows, I spent about 2 months listening to every Avid Brothers song and making note cards on every single one of them. And you guys have recorded a lot, by the way, if you didn't know that. Believe me, I do know that. You know, so as I was considering each song, characters started emerging. Because I didn't want to tell the historical story of the Mignonette. I thought that was too constricting. But I love the idea of four men in a lifeboat against impossible circumstances. So as I listened to the songs, characters began to emerge, plot began to emerge. And as I sort of narrowed the song list down, then sort of the spine of the plot sort of came together. And then, you know, I said, okay, here's what I think it is. Here's what I think the songs are, which has remained, Johnny, pretty solid from the very beginning. And then I went and pitched my heart out to the Avid Brothers saying, okay, this is what I want to do. Here's the songs. Here's the story. This happens, this. And I was trying to be very sort of dramatic. I'm not an actor. And this was in Scott's kitchen. And I was like falling to my knees and praying to God and singing the songs. And, you know, they were amused and delighted. And thankfully they said, yeah, they love it. And that was, and then I wrote it. And that was how it all started.
You know, Johnny, you've done something similar to this before. You were an American Idiot, which is based on the music of Green Day. So how has it been, you know, first of all, what can you tell us about your character? I know we don't want to give it all away at all, but what can you tell us about your character and what is it like taking these interpretations of the popular music of the day, if you will? I don't know how popular our music is of the day, but then taking them out of their original context.
I, especially with the playwright here, I can't say too much about the fella that I play, but he is the second mate on a triple master whaling ship in the late 1800s, sailing out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. And he's a complicated character. He's full of contradictions and he's kind of impulsive and manipulative and erratic and extremely charming all at the same time. And he finds himself at a real crossroads and a real moment of truth in his life that becomes kind of the crux of the play. One thing I'll say about working on the musicals that I've worked on, and this is only my third musical. I've done a lot of theater, but I've only done a handful of musicals, and I've just been ridiculously spoiled by the artists that I've gotten to work with in my musicals, going from Green Day to the Avett Brothers. Just to kind of set up a little bit of context, what's kind of funny is that when I was doing American Idiot on Broadway in 2010, I had an Avett Brothers poster in my dressing room. And it was a picture from the Live Volume 3 record. And it was a picture of Scott and his banjo, I think with the kind of I Am Loving You teardrop design that was on his banjo at the time. I think he was kind of holding his banjo up or passing it off to a roadie, and it just said the Avett Brothers. And I hung it on my wall at American Idiot, because I've been such a fan since 2005 was the first time I saw you guys live. And I instant fandom. And I think I've seen 15 concerts now. And so I'm a massive fan. And so it's an absolute dream come true. It's just a gift the likes of which I could have never imagined that I would, you know, one day be handed some of these songs and this incredible character, and being given the task of combining two of my absolute favorite art forms, you know, amazing music and incredible theater, and then smashing it all together. And one thing that's kind of strange is that I've at once had to embrace the things that I love about the Avett Brothers and about Scott and Seth's writing, and then also throw a lot of it away. Because as much as I kind of want to just pretend that I'm doing Avett Brothers karaoke and just do my best, you know, Scott and Seth impression, there's this character that I'm also trying to, you know, build on stage, and then working John's writing into that. And so it's just this kind of creative melting pot where I really get to kind of just hammer out some of my favorite material, the emotional depth of John's writing and the emotional depth of Scott and Seth's writing really complement each other. And getting to sing through the whole thing with a live audience last night for the first time, I really felt that of how kind of organically the two come together. I just have been so lucky to have the musicals that I've worked on be so unique and be so special and be interesting in the way that they do bring the popular music of our time to the stage, which is such a tried and true tradition. And it's really cool to be part of that legacy and pushing it forward with a new band. And to have people, like last night, I had a few people come up to me at the stage door and say, "Well, you know, I see everything at the Berkeley Rep and I love musical theater, but I've never heard an Avett Brothers song before." And I just thought, oh my gosh, that person is in for such a treat now, because they get to go comb through the discography and discover all of this great music.
This could be our big break. Ben, if I could just one to John Logan here, attaches to what Johnny was saying. What I find really exciting about I find many things really exciting about this project, but I am an immense jazz lover. Like, I met Scott and Seth when I was just getting into the upright bass and studying jazz, you know, in college, and third time through college. But the corpus of the American jazz songbook are show tunes. It's these songs like from Porgy and Bess, from Guys and Dolls, that were ripped off the stage and performed, stripped down in nightclubs by jazz musicians, by, you know, Bix Beiderbecke or Miles Davis or Sonny Rollins or John Coltrane. And that is the jazz, we call it the real book, right? And that's the book that jazz musicians play out of. And it's show tunes. And so this project is so exciting because it's incredible. Like, if this music is going to continue on beyond our lifetime, it has to be taken out of the context of us and out of the people who first, wrote it and performed it and took it around the country. It needs to take on a life outside of the context. And that's what's really exciting about this, you know. John, maybe speak to that. That idea of where this popular American music comes from.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, I grew up with, you know, my family played Frank Sinatra all the time. So classic jazz, classic standards to me were always interdigited with show tunes and with Broadway and with performance in some way. And one of the reasons I was so excited to do the show is something Johnny touched on as well, which is, you know, Scott and Seth's music is stage worthy. And the stage is a sacred place to me. And to get to introduce that music to people who had never heard it before, I think is an incredible gift. One of the things that made me most excited. Because you're right to say that if one stays in the calcified presentation of a work of art, a song, for example, and you're always going to hear that song in the same way, it becomes a museum piece and it loses currency, it loses relevance. The only way for art to continue to be relevant to different audiences, younger audiences, international audiences, is for it to be reinterpreted. And I love it when a play of mine is done in a completely different way than the first production, because that shows it's a living, breathing thing. And that's what is so unique about live theater and live performance. Every single show has to be unique and special. So to be able to take the work that Scott and Seth did, the performance of that, and think of it to be inspired to create something new that's fresh and different, I think is the way that all art sort of goes on and continues. Would you agree, Johnny?
Yeah, I would. I think that's so beautifully said. That the word legacy comes to mind, of that you have something in its original form, but it's true, Bob, that if it is to spread to cast a wider net, it does need to kind of infiltrate other art forms and become something almost bigger than where it began.
Yeah, and the trick for this show, which is interesting, because we had a lot of Ava Brother fans there last night.
Yeah,
one of them was sitting two seats away from me. And so she got every song. She's like, oh, it's Hard Worker. You just like heard her get excited. But then when we changed things and it wasn't the recording she was so completely used to, you felt that moment of sort of like, oh, I'm surprised. Maybe I'm delighted. Maybe I'm horrified. You know, so for fans of the music, it's that constant evaluation of like, I love that I know this kind of, but they're doing this with it. Am I comfortable going that far away from the way I hear it? And that's going to be, I think, Johnny, interesting for us every night to see how they respond. The fans are responding.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of fascinating because it is that thing of like, I'm such a fan. And so I want, you want to deliver something that's going to please all the Ava Brothers fans. And yet what I love about what the play, you know, that John has written is that it pulls no punches, and it is a complicated and challenging night at the theater. Not to make it sound like a task or a homework assignment or something, because there are these bright moments of catharsis and joy and levity and all the stuff that you get when you go to an Ava Brothers concert, but you've kind of equalized it with all of the flip side of the coin, which is one of the things that I love the most about Scott and Seth's writing, is that it dares to be a little bit of everything, and that you'll have these kind of, you know, like foot stomping numbers, and then you'll have like a genuinely introspective and sometimes devastating ballad. And John, you really have, you know, picked all of the best elements of that catalog in order to tell a really unique and intense story. But I was happy to look out in the audience a few times and see people clapping along, which doesn't always happen, you know, at a night at the theater. And to see people that into the music was like, okay, I think we're doing something right if the Avid fans are, you know, are clapping their hands already.
I want to take a second here and talk to our friend Jamie Jeschke from La Cosecha Coffee. Jamie, how are you doing, man?
Real good, Ben. Good to talk to you.
You have been sponsoring us for years. We love your coffee. We love what you guys do out there in Maplewood, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis. And one of my favorite things now is that we'll get people who hit us up on social media, unrelated to anything else, and be like, you're right, La Cosecha Coffee is so good. So tell us about what you guys are doing.
You know, we're just a small roaster and coffee bar in St. Louis. And I feel like, especially last year, we just really started getting a lot of your listeners on board with ordering coffee.
That's great. Given the repeat customers that are coming from Road to Now to you, do you have any suggestions for somebody who really likes La Cosecha coffee, but sometimes we'll forget to order and run out?
Totally. The number one thing that we've noticed that people have enjoyed is our subscription service, and it'll just keep coming to you and you don't have to think about it.
Well, that's awesome, man. I'm glad you could join us. And the website is lacosechacoffee.com. That's LACOSECHA.com. Use promo code RTN10. The number 10 for 10% off your order. So thanks for being here. It's nice to be able to reintroduce you again to our listeners. Have a great day, man.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
So Johnny, you said you saw the Avett Brothers for the first time in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Where was it and how old were you?
I was 20 years old and it was at the Philadelphia Folk Festival in Schwanksville, Pennsylvania. Which I've been going to since I was 8 years old. My parents started taking me to that festival. I grew up in Delaware and my dad started going to that folk festival when he was a young man. And it became kind of a family tradition. And every summer I would go there with my sisters and my parents. And I was exposed to so much great music that way. The exciting thing was that every year, you know, every now and then, you know, there'd be a lot of legacy acts. And, you know, I saw Judy Collins there and I saw the band there and I saw Richie Havens and I saw Buddy Guy and Tom Paxton and a lot of great folk artists. But every now and then you'd get somebody coming up, you know, you'd get like a new band. And I really remember it like it was yesterday. I was walking up a hill to go find my parents and I heard somebody introduce, I said, okay, from Concord, North Carolina, if you haven't seen these guys already, you know, before, I think you're really going to dig them. Here are the Avett Brothers. And I remember that Talk on Indolence was the first song that y'all played and it stopped me in my tracks. And I turned around. I'd never heard anything like it. It was everything I loved about roots music and bluegrass music, but delivered with a kind of Nirvana meets the Replacements type of reckless energy and rock and roll enthusiasm. And I just turned around and I stood there and watched the whole set and immediately ran to the merch tent and bought Mignonette, which I think was the only record that you all were selling at that show. And I became an instant fan. And I thought, oh, this is the coolest band. That this is like the new American band of these years for me. And has remained so, such an informative act. And I've, you know, seen you guys go from small folk festivals to theaters to being in arenas to see your concerts. And it's been really cool. I'm one of many fans that has been along for that ride. And it's been such a cool one. And I still can't believe that now I'm somehow at this juncture where I'm, you know, collaborating alongside y'all. It's a total gift.
So I asked you that question for a reason. First of all, I like hearing these things. I grew up with Scott and Seth. We went to high school together, back home in the homelands. And so that's interesting to me, but more interesting to me is the way you talked about them earlier suggests that you had this moment, this connection. And you said 2005, you were young. And to me that, how much tension was there when you go to this thing that when you grow up with music, it's in you. And you've got an idea of what it means to you. How much tension is there when you're performing another person's interpretation of that? I mean, it's not like you just like the band. It's a band that you have this deep connection with. Was it hard?
You know, it's the kind of thing where I think in the early days, there's always this, you know, and even when I did American Idiot, there's the biggest fear is that the people that I look up to that created it are somehow not going to be into what we're trying to make with it. Back in 2018, we did a reading and it sort of felt like, you know, Bob, like our audition, maybe, you know, when you and Dolph and Scott and Seth came to see us read through the play for the first time in New York City, you know, that was a little bit of a nervy night. Cause I just thought, I think John's script's incredible. It's one of the greatest plays I've ever read as an actor. And then we got the Avett songs on top of it. I mean, I love it. I think it's kind of great. but what if they don't dig it? You know, I had this fear that they were going to be like, you've gone too far with it. Or why are you singing it that way? Or why did you cast this guy? Why is he singing this song? You know? But then, you know, afterwards the look on your faces, you know, kind of told us all, I think it was like, oh, I think we passed.
Yeah.
I think we nailed the audition here. You know?
No, it was perfect. It was perfect. I mean, from the story on down to the performances, it was, I think we were all just, you know, I don't know. There were somebody in our group was taking notes, but, I'm sure you guys got those notes, but I think we were all just like blown away, and I personally was, yeah, this makes sense. It's like, oh yeah, this is obvious that this story and the performances and the casting, it all was just seemed like, and that's a sign of you're onto something when it just makes perfect sense. And it seems like it probably already exists. It always has existed in some realm.
And I just want to say that I asked that question because having heard how much you enjoy them, it makes it really impressive to me that you're able to perform in this way. That's the reason I asked the question, because that was more like a, how do you do this even? Like someone hands you the greatest songs that are in your heart and goes, do them differently, right? Do them for the band differently. So that's all I wanted to say there.
Absolutely. What I'll say is, and it leads me into the brilliance of Mr. John Logan, is that, you know, he has fit these songs into this show where there's no choice but for them to have a kind of new life and take on a different meaning and a deeper meaning. And so it's very easy to sing these songs and realize, oh, actually, these are now coming from my character's perspective and from this other standpoint, and they're fitting in to this larger arc of this piece. And John makes it easy. He makes it easy to step into those shoes and say, oh, now I'm going to have to, I, even though of course I will always be a big Avery Brothers fan, I have to kind of, that side of me goes away for a little bit. And now I'm just the interpreter, and I just have to allow it to pass from the page through me and to the audience.
Johnny was talking about this idea of the artist not liking what you've done with their music, or someone not being happy with the storyline. Have you ever like come across that or experienced that? Because you've written in many genres, right? Many different stage, screen, video game. You've done it all. I mean, literally, you've done it all.
Yeah, it's challenging. Whenever you're adapting another artist's work in any way, you know, it's always a very treacherous minefield. You know, I wrote the screen version of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, which is his masterwork, you know. And my very first meeting with Stephen Sondheim, who I'd never met before, but I grew up worshiping as a theater mouse, I had to sit down and say, may I call you Steve? Yeah, you can call me Steve. We're going to have to cut an hour of your music. Thank you. And then I'll leave. You know, because you know, it's an opera and it's a movie. We have 2 hours, less than 2 hours. That ended up being fine because Steve took the time to educate me on the score. We spent 5 years working on that screenplay, working on the score, learning why he did certain things. And I would say, for example, well, I think this song needs to communicate more in the movie because of what we've cut, because it's a different structure. And he said, no, that was very hard fought simplicity, this song. And let me explain why. So that's a give and take, which is the best possible way to work. You know, Scott and Seth, it's been a give and take. I was like, can we cut this verse? Could you write some new lines here for this? And it's been very fluid in a very comfortable way. The worst thing is when you're working with someone, you're adapting like a screenplay from a novel, and they just hate it. They're like, well, it's not the novel. And you have to say, well, yes, it's not the novel because it's a different form. Like I wrote the book to the musical Moulin Rouge, which is now, thank God, still playing on Broadway. And the movie, Baz Luhrmann's movie, is a very particular cinematic beast. But our stage show couldn't be that beast because on the stage, we don't have wet pans, and we don't have close-ups, and we don't have fancy editing. It's all in real time right in front of you. So when Baz first came to see a workshop, I think there was a little dissonance in terms of the changes we had to make it work on the stage as opposed to on the screen. And then was very supportive of the whole project. So it's always a dance that you do with an original artist. All I can say is that you know, thank goodness Scott and Seth mean so open and willing to listen and willing to, you know, to help.
In my side life, I've written some things like scripts and things like this. And I only say this that I read a ton of things because I'm, you know, I'm also got a PhD in history. So I'm a nerd. So I'm just like, let's learn what I can learn. I read a ton of books on writing, listened to a ton of interviews, podcasts with a lot of different directors and writers and how things are made. And when I was prepping for this, I listened to a couple of interviews with you, John Logan. And I've never heard someone talk so collaboratively about the way they write. Like just that you're working with people, like it was as if you were a collaborator and not kind of a, I own the script. And I wonder how much of that comes out of, you know, your origins in theater. Does that shape the way that you do this and the way you think about scripts?
Entirely. Because like, you know, like Johnny, I grew up doing storefront theater for no money. And you're all in the trenches at the same time when you're making theater. And the playwright, the stage director, the lighting guy, the front of house manager, the actors, you're all in the same underheated, underpaid room, you know? And so you learn the sort of like trench mentality of creating art. And I didn't write my first screenplay until I was 30. So the time I got into it, I was like, my job is to collaborate, you know, with Marty Scorsese or Ridley Scott. It's like, what do you want? How can I get there? This is my thought. This is your thought. And then with actors, you know, the chief collaboration a playwright has is with the director and the actors, you know, obviously. And as Johnny will testify, I stay away. I let the director do the job because I need to be very fresh eyes when I see it, because the director and the cast, they need that. So I was there for like the first read through and I'm like, great, I'll make some little tweaks maybe. And then I went away for 2 weeks while they created it. Because I have trust. I've learned to have trust in directors, you know, and Michael Mayer, our director, is a brilliant director, you know, a renowned director, a strong director. And he didn't meet me there sitting there, you know, trying to solve problems or getting bored and wanting to rewrite things, you know. So it's trust in your collaborators. I also had unique trust in this cast because our four principals are, you know, everyone's an angel and there's something sacred about what they do. And I knew that they felt deeply about the show. This wasn't a paycheck to anyone. So that was, you know, it was easy for me to stay away and trust my colleagues, if that's an answer.
John, you've written James Bond movies.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that? I just got to say, what is that like?
Skyfall was the most pleasurable experience I've ever had working as a screenwriter, because Sam Mendes, the director, and I, it was our first Bond. We didn't want to mess up the franchise. You know, we had great respect for the franchise. And, you know, the producers, Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson, who sort of shepherd the franchise, were willing to let us try things, willing to let us do strange things that they hadn't done before. So it was joyous. And it's also, there's something cool about working in a project where part of your job is to go to the Aston Martin factory and see the new Aston Martin or go to like the Walther company to fire the new James Bond gun. You know, yeah. So there's fringe benefits around Bond that don't exist anywhere in the world, nor should they, because it's very unique.
Well, I mean, I could just imagine you have this character that people have come to, I mean, people who are really into those films, I mean, they know all the different actors who've portrayed the character, and they know every nuance about that character's personality. And you are in this position where you can add a new depth or something that, you know, show a new side of this character that's never existed before. And it just must be an incredible responsibility, but also a creative joy.
It's intimidating, you know, because you have the weight of all those movies and all those novels behind you. But like, you know, I would do the same thing Johnny would do any project, which I just did the research. I read all the Ian Fleming books. I took notes on them. I watched all the movies. So I knew the mythos of Bond very deeply. So when we deviated from that mythos, we were at least aware we were doing it. Mm-hmm. And the audiences, frankly, really, I think, appreciated it in Skyfall, mm-hmm. particularly that it was like there's something fresh.
I love that one personally, John. It's a fantastic entry.
Thank you.
So good.
I heard you talk about it, and I hadn't thought about it at the time, but another interview when it came out, you had said that there's a lot of pressure when you're creating that movie, because it's like every kid in England wants to be, like every boy in England wants to be James Bond when they grow up. And so it's interesting, the connections here, where you're taking something that has pre-established reverence and then turning in it and making it your own. That's fascinating.
John, is there a genre that you just, that you love above the others to write in?
Musicals. Yeah, mostly on, I mean, I love the stage more than anything, you know, because like the same way Johnny and I would talk about what it's like coming up as a theater professional, where you make no money and you have day jobs and there's no recognition, there's no anything. It's also gloriously pure. And I love being in the rehearsal room. I love creating theater. And musical theater, I think, is such a unique and exciting art form, an accessible art form, and a very elastic art form. You know, just in, as you know, John's experience going from American Idiot to Swept Away is like mine going from Moulin Rouge, which has 36 people, and it's this huge show, into a very, very small show. And so musical theater really gives you the chance to explore in an exciting visual way. And there's choreography and people are in the room singing. It's like fantastic. What about you, Johnny? Do you like the old musical or the old straight play or the old movie?
I do love the stage. I think you get so, it's kind of, as much as I love working in film and television, I mean, just nothing even touches a half hour in the rehearsal room working on a new play. You know, it's a completely other drug, you know, night and day to be given, you know, just this kind of, you know, this wealth of language and history and the challenges and the assignment of building a piece of theater. It just, it calls on all four senses and everything you've got at once to kind of throw it all at the wall to find the best way through to tell the story. It's such a cool challenge.
Yeah, there's also something special about unique that, Bob, you must feel when you're performing, which is theaters themselves are very haunted places. So when you step onto a stage, Johnny, you're like, oh, this is the theater where Oklahoma premiered, mm-hmm. or this is the theater where I played in. And so all those ghosts stay with you. The same way, Bob, when you're performing, you're like, oh yeah, I remember that performance. It gets into your skin after a while and becomes your, it's like a cloak you wear of your history and the history of, I can't believe so-and-so stood on this very square of wood and sang Impossible Dream, you know.
We played somewhere in Lawrence, Kansas, I believe, and Ben will appreciate this, that Horace Greeley spoke at, you know, so it's, and then, you know, of course, the theaters, they all have their histories. They all have their, Bing Crosby started here in Spokane, Washington, or the Great Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, the Grateful Dead, Janis. I mean, everybody played there. So yeah, you definitely there's the spirits are there. The spirits, they live. Hey Johnny, I wanted to ask you, you've played in bands,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you did for a while.
Yeah,
like that, you know. So I mean, there's got to be something to that, and people would see, if they see, we're going to post that video you playing Once in Future Carpenter, but I mean that is, it's not like you got a fake being a singer or a performer. I mean, you know what that feels like.
Yeah, I played in bands longer than I've been a professional actor. You know, I started writing songs and playing in bands, you know, in high school, much like many suburban teenagers. You know, that was my outlet and my kind of introduction to storytelling and creativity, and I still do. You know, I kind of self-finance and self-release my own records, and I play drums in another band back in New York, and then I front my own band in New York, and it's never really become anything more than what I would kind of call a glorified hobby, in that it, you know, the fire hasn't took to it the same way that it has, you know, fortunately for me as an actor. But it's absolutely something that I can't live without. You know, I'm always like, I don't leave home without my guitar, and I'm always writing songs, and I'm always keeping that outlet alive. And it's, you know, helpful and therapeutic and just a great source of joy. But yeah, you know, I think there's a reason why I've only really done, when you get the musicals I've done, that it was, you know, Duncan Sheik, Green Day, and the Avett Brothers. I think there's a reason why I skew more towards kind of a folk or a rock and roll style musical. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'll try someday. I don't know how I would fare in a Sondheim musical or a more classical piece of musical theater. I don't know vocally if I would, you know, be up to the challenge and the nuance that's required for that type of thing. But yeah, I think there's a reason why I've been more drawn to the popular music musical as opposed to something slightly more traditional. And it makes it makes the rehearsal room fun because I can have kind of a shorthand with the musical director and with the band. And I can kind of be like, oh, you know, I think the way that you guys are doing the kick drum hi-hat thing is kind of messing us up for getting into other songs. So if you listen to Nothing Short of Thankful on Mignonette, you can actually hear that, you know, he's actually doing the kind of, Scott's doing the kind of claw hammer thing on the banjo strings. And, you know, I can kind of meddle, with their job in a way to kind of be more collaborative and everything. So it makes it fun. And it makes it, I don't know, it gives an ease to the proceedings for me that I really value.
Well, I just have 100 questions about like, about just generally about like the art of performance, because I'm so fascinated in this. Like, just a side note, whenever we booked this, I was like, hey, Bob, can you send me the script? Like, send me some stuff. And he was like, no. And I was like, okay. Literally email was like, nah, but I understand it's you guys are
yeah, keeping I don't have it. I'm sorry. I don't have it, man. Sorry, man. I can't help you. Well, so no, but I think Ben, you bring out a good point here, because it's very important to not reveal much more than we've revealed. Mm. So this will run for 8 weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, I think till the second week of March, I believe it is.
That's right. Yeah.
And then what happens to Swept Away? Is it Swept Away? Is that
no,
it?
No, we hope not. I mean, you know, this is, you know, and Berkeley Rep has been fantastic. They've given us a first home to like see the piece in front of an audience, you know, which is the first step of any creating any sort of theater piece. So this is our first step to look at it, see how the audience responds. Obviously, I hope that it will continue on. I'd love for my friends in New York to be able to see the show. I'd love my friends in London to be able to see the show, because I think the music is worthy. I think the drama is worthy, and I think the performances are worthy. And the best thing you can say about Swept Away, I honestly believe, is there is nothing else like it. It is very unique. And, you know, in our world of mass-produced, cellophane-wrapped entertainment, to do something unique and provocative you haven't seen before, I think is incredibly thrilling. So I have to believe other people will want to experience that.
I have to say that what I've seen of the set design is also, adding to the whole, you know, to the whole uniqueness and the singular quality of the writing of the story and the performance of the music and the way the music's been interpreted. You got to go see it to see the set, because it's incredible what they've created.
Yeah, it is. It is quite special. It's like you look at the cast and you think, oh, what a tiny little show this is, you know, because there's really only four principals and a little company. And then you see the way it's presented. It's presented with the scope of a proper epic sea tale, which is what it is. You know, it's like my inspirations for the show were the Avett brothers, Herman Melville and Joseph Conrad, you know, and it aspires to that. And it aspires to that emotionally, but it certainly succeeds in that in terms of how it's presented on stage.
Yeah.
Johnny Gallagher, John Logan, thank you so much. Best of luck. Well, break a leg.
Break a leg. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Text a link to a friend, share a link on social media, or take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. All of this helps us spread the word about our show. So if you've already done that, thank you. Speaking of thank you, now's the time where we say the special shout out to our supporters on Patreon, with particular emphasis on our Washingtonians. Thank you to Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams and Frank Edwards, and Daniel Hansen. To all of you, we are grateful. If you're enjoying what you hear on The Road to Now, you can join us there on Patreon too. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. There are extra episodes, bonus materials, and you can even join us for an upcoming trivia night or live recordings. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. Our patrons keep us going. For more on this episode and our podcast in general, please visit our website, www.theroadtonow.com, where you can easily search our back catalog and quickly find links to content. You're going to be amazed by that website. And you want to know why? Because it was designed by Charles and Destiny at Seven Ages Design. Go check those guys out. They made our lives a lot easier and made us look a lot better. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer and the editor of this episode is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening. Take care.